is the area of relationships. And I'm sure that everybody that's here tonight has at some time or another been hurt in a relationship, whether we're talking about parent-children relationships or whether we're talking about friends, whether we're talking about a dating situation. It's very easy to get hurt in a relationship because you get your feelings involved, and your feelings are very sensitive, your soul is very sensitive, and as a result you can end up in a lot of pain. Now, that's going to happen to you no matter what you do in life, because relationships are like that. Some are good, some are bad, some last, some don't. Some are built on a good foundation, some are not built on a good foundation. But young people, there's one thing that this book teaches us, and it's interesting that this is the only book in the Bible dedicated to teach you how to build a worthwhile marriage relationship. Now, there are marriage principles all the way through the Bible, but this is the only book that is dedicated to teach you how to do it right. This book's 3,000 years old, but as we've found already, and we're going to see it again and again and again, it's very up to date. As a matter of fact, tonight we're going to find out it's very, very up to date, maybe more so than you think. You remember that we saw last time the Shulamite woman, and she was asking the question, where do you shepherd your sheep? You remember that Solomon is searching for a queen, and he sent his servants out, and he sent the daughters of Jerusalem out, and they went all through the land. And they came back and they reported about the beauty queens in the various areas, but there was one that stood out above all the others. And she's known in the poem, in the song, because this is a song, it's also a poem, and it's also a play. And she's known in this play as the Shulamite woman. And they came back and they reported to him, so he wanted to go and check this young lady out. But he didn't want to go as the king riding in his chariot with all his retainers. He wanted to go as a humble shepherd. He wanted to find out what she was really like. So he stopped by as a humble shepherd, dressed in a shepherd's garb. And he paid a visit to her home, possibly, as we developed the scenario a little bit last time, which you have to do in a poem, in a play like this. He stopped by and asked for a drink of water, and she brought him a cool drink of water, and he observed her and saw the work that she was doing, and possibly sat in the house for a while talking with her mother, as would be common for a shepherd that was stopping by, and so forth. We saw that this young lady had a very unhappy home situation. Her brothers were very inconsiderate, and basically they allotted to her the job of taking care of the family vineyard. And she had to take care of the family business so that they could presumably go out and have a good time. But she worked hard at it. She had good character. She had integrity. And she labored, and that's why she makes the statement that we saw earlier in verse 6 of the first chapter, "Don't look at me because I'm dark. I'm sunburned. My mother's sons were angry with me." That's a good way to refer to your brothers. My mother's sons. You know, it's kind of like when parents have trouble with their kid, it's always, "Do you know what your son did today?" You know, it's not mine, it's yours. "They made me keeper of the vineyards, but my own vineyard I have not kept." Now, one of the things we have to do as we go through this beautiful poem is we have to understand the way that different figures of speech are used, because it's very, very relevant to our study. And we came on through, and so she's asking the question, where do you shepherd your flocks? And we saw that she was told to be patient. She was told to wait. And in due time, this relationship is going to turn into a wonderful and a beautiful relationship. We're going to begin in chapter 2, and we begin with a very important principle. She is now speaking, and sometimes she speaks, sometimes he speaks, and this is what she says. "I am the rose of Sharon and the lily of the valleys." Now that may sound very romantic and very beautiful, but to us it conveys the opposite of what she's trying to say. What she's trying to say is, "I am very common. The rose of Sharon is a very common little wild flower. It's not like a rose like we think of a rose. The lily of the valleys, these are two very, very common wildflowers." And she's saying, "I'm very common. I'm just like any other girl. I'm not different than anyone else." And the principle that I want you to get to here is very, very important. No matter how common you may think you are, no matter how ordinary you may feel, when you meet your mate, when God brings to you that one that He designed for you, to that person you are going to be exceptional. You are going to be totally unique. And all of the things about you that you think make you ordinary, or things about you that you think maybe make you less than someone else, those are going to be the very things that that person is going to find to be very, very attractive. I am the rose of Sharon and the lily of the valleys. I am very common. But I want you to notice how he responds in verse 2. Like a lily among thorns, so is my love among the daughters. In other words, she says, I'm like one of a million flowers. And he says, no, you're like one flower in a thorn bush. All the others look like thorns. Compared to you, every other woman is like a thorn bush. I don't know when you looked last, but thorn bushes aren't all that attractive, especially if you get too close. And he's saying, you are like a lily among the thorn bushes. All others compared to her in his eyes. And remember that to a degree, beauty is in the eyes of the one looking. Beauty is in the eyes of the beholder. He sees her as being unique. He sees her that no one else compares to her. So I want you to jot down a couple of things along with that principle. Be willing to wait for the one who sees the uniqueness that is in you. Don't be in a hurry, young people. Be willing to wait. Be willing to be patient. Be willing to pray. You should be praying now. God, bring me to that one at the right time. And in the meantime, I want you to be preparing me. I want you to be making me the kind of person that I ought to be. You remember that I said last time, if you're concerned about finding the person that you want to find, make sure first that you're the person you ought to be. Be concerned about being the kind of person that they're going to want and that they're going to desire. You mold yourself now so that you are the kind of person that you should be when you find them. Secondly, don't fall for somebody just because they show you a little attention. You know, the oldest game in the books is for some guy to come along with a quick line and a few dollars to spend and roll you off your feet or sweep you off your feet or whatever with a little attention. Don't fall for somebody just because they show you a little attention. And it's especially hard if you're in a situation like this girl because things in her home were not good. Her father apparently was not there. Maybe he had left. Maybe he had died. She doesn't have that affection that all of us need. It would have been very easy for her to have just gotten swept away by the first guy that came along with a mouthful of teeth and a nice line. Be careful. Guard yourself. We're going to see how she protects herself and how he protects her, and it's a beautiful story. Now she talks about him. Look at verse 3. In the first couple of chapters, by the way, what we're doing is we're just seeing them beginning to develop a relationship. They've noticed each other. They're interested in each other. They talk about what they like about each other. And then things begin to develop as they should develop. She says of him, verse 3, like an apple tree among the trees of the woods, so is my beloved among the sons. I sat down in his shade with great delight, and his fruit was sweet to my taste. The woman should sense protection in the presence of the one that she's interested in. Now, this ought to begin in dating. She should sense that she is protected. She says, I sat down in his shade. And the idea is that she is protected from the rays of the sun. But in the application, it's saying, he protects me. He makes me feel safe. He makes me feel secure. He's not like so many guys today that say, look, if we're out on a date and somebody makes a wisecrack at you or makes a pass at you, don't count on me to protect you. Young ladies, if that's the guy's attitude, dump him. That's not the kind of guy that you're going to be interested in that's going to take care of you. He protects her. All right? So he is like an apple tree among the trees of the woods. The apple tree in the ancient world was very, very valuable. They valued apples. Apples were very nutritious. You've probably all heard the old saying, an apple a day keeps the doctor away. The idea of the apple, they used the apple in many ways. We're going to see in just a few moments, they used it for smelling salts. Somebody's fainted, they'd cut a fresh apple, stick it under their nose, let them breathe it in, and revive them. But apples were valued. If you had an apple tree among your trees on your property, it was very, very valuable. She said, he is like an apple tree in a forest. Now he looks at her and he says, a lily among thorns. She looks at him and says, an apple tree among the forest. Very valuable, very priceless. But even more than that, he's someone who nourishes me. He's someone who protects me. His shade protects me, and like the apple, he nourishes me. In other words, she's talking about the tender care that this guy shows to her. You young ladies, it doesn't take very long to be around a guy to tell whether he has those qualities or not. Is he someone that would protect you? Is he someone that would lay down his life if necessary for you? Would he stand between you and harm's way? Does he nurture you? Does he nourish you? Does he strengthen you, or is he just there to be a parasite to sap from you what he wants? You have to be sharp. You have to be prepared. You have to be alert to these things so that you don't get sucked in, so that you don't get bled dry, and then you end up a wasted shell while some guy goes on his way looking for fresh game, looking for some new opportunity. Don't throw yourself away. Don't squander yourself. Always remember something. You must set the standard of your own value. You must determine what you're worth. And when you determine what you're worth, that's exactly the way people are going to treat you. So his shade is his guardianship. And I want to remind you that in 1 Peter chapter 3 and verse 1, where it says, likewise, wives, submit to your husband, that likewise follows the last verse of 1 Peter 2. We all, like sheep, had gone astray, but we have now returned to the guardian and the shepherd of our souls. Likewise, wives, be in submission to your husbands. The chapter break destroys the continuity there, because what it's saying is the man is to be the guardian and the shepherd of the woman's soul. Now, the guardian in the ancient world was a very important figure. We've all read in the ancient mythology about guys like Hercules and the guys that were the great heroes. But in the ancient Greek world, there were men who were called guardians. And they were over the village, and basically they were the defender of the village. They were the village hero. They were the village strongman. They were the guy that could run the fastest, the guy that could fight and defend people. He was called a guardian because he saw that his responsibility... He had an attitude that I tried to instill into my sons when they were small. When you grow up, when you are big, and they're big now, you've seen them, and they're strong. I said, when God gives you size and strength and health, it's your responsibility to take care of the weak. It's your responsibility to take care of those that can't take care of themselves. You have been given by God strength to protect other people. It's your responsibility. There's no excuse for the kind of things that we all read about happening where someone gets attacked and people stand by and they watch. They don't want to get involved. We have lost the mentality of integrity, of loyalty, of character that recognizes that we are our brother's keeper and we should undertake in behalf of one another. So he's caring for her. He's showing that kind of consideration. He's being the guardian of her soul. And you'll notice how much he talks about his presence and what it did for her. You remember back in the previous chapter, she talks about how pleasant it was. Look at verse 16 of chapter 1. Behold, you are handsome, my beloved, yes, pleasant. Now, handsome means one thing. That has to do with looks. Pleasant means something else. Pleasant means that you're comfortable to be with. Here she says that she delights with the fruit that he produces, the fruit of kindness, the fruit of gentleness, the fruit of consideration, the fact that he's attentive to her, the fact that he takes care of her, that he watches out for her. She said it's a delight, and she's talking about how enjoyable it is to be with someone that she can trust and someone she can rely on. They're building compatibility. They're building a rapport. They're building a fellowship between their souls. And this is what you want to look for. Now, beginning in verse 4 and running through verse 6, she talks about a date. We've seen one date in the previous chapter. They went out on a picnic. They were under the trees, and she talked about feeling like she was a queen in a palace. And she looked up as she lay back on the grass, and she saw the branches above her head, and she said, I feel like a queen in a palace, and the rafters above my head are cedar and fir. Our couch is green, which is an idiom that means that they did not violate the sexual boundaries in their relationship. They kept things where they were supposed to be. They put restrictions on themselves. Now she's going to talk about the next date. Let me read it for you, verse 4 to 6. You can do a little daydreaming here while I'm reading. He brought me to the banqueting house, and his banner over me was love. Sustain me with cakes of raisins. Refresh me with apples, for I am lovesick. This girl is falling in love with this guy. All right? And this book, by the way, doesn't pull any punches. It tells it like it is. Verse 6, his left hand is under my head, and his right hand embraces me. Now, at this point, and some translations actually say, let his left hand be under my head and let his right hand embrace me. And I'll explain that to you in just a moment. First of all, let's look at the date. The first one was in the wood. This one is at what she calls the banqueting house. Now, literally, the Hebrew says the house of wine. But you can have the idea here that they're going out to a nice restaurant. That would be the equivalent of today. There are those who study the poem and look at all the Hebrew imagery who feel that they weren't even really going to a banquet house, because remember, what was Solomon trying to do? He was trying to appear as a poor shepherd. Their first date was on a picnic out in the woods. Some people believe that the banqueting house, or the house of wine, was in the vineyard. They've met in the vineyard, and they're again getting to know each other. And the vineyard, the trellises with the vines overhead are above her, and she, as she's looking at it, and she's thinking, his banner over me is love. So there's all this symbolism, but it tells us about the fact that they're building the relationship properly. What kind of principles can we pull out of this? Number one, love, which is genuine, throws a protective banner over all words and actions. He brought me to the banqueting house, and his banner over me was love. But it tells us something else. Not only is his conduct controlled by genuine love, not lust, not I'm here for what I can get, but I'm here for what I can give. And by the way, young people, that is what dating is for. Dating is designed to teach you how to establish a relationship. Don't blow it from the beginning. Most people, the minute they get into dating, they want to go straight into as if they were married, and they're not. They're far from it, and they destroy their souls. And they destroy their ability to lay a good solid foundation. Jesus said a wise man builds his house on a solid foundation. Too many people build their house on sinking sand, and then they wonder. Look at the world out there today. Look at the divorce rate. Do you think the world out there has anything to tell you about building a right relationship? If you listen to the world, young people, the best they could tell you is you got a 50-50 chance of even sticking it out. And even if you stick it out, you're probably going to be miserable. Who would want to take their advice? But I can tell you this, as I've told you before. In a survey that was done extensively throughout the United States of America, this is what they found. In those places, in those homes, in those families, where both the man and the woman were Christians, believers in Jesus Christ, both the man and the woman attended church together, both the man and the woman studied the Word of God and prayed together, they found one divorce in 1,500. You tell me, who knows how to build a solid marriage? The world or the Bible? Which direction do you want to take? The world's direction or the Bible? If you want to have any kind of a relationship, you're going to want to build it biblically, and this is why we're studying this book. So love puts a banner over everything. The second thing we notice is that great care must be exercised to avoid falling into sexual temptation. This book has a lot to say about sexual temptation. Now, there's one thing that we recognize, and that is there is an attraction to members of the opposite sex. And getting to the age that you're getting to, that is going to become a very strong factor. Stronger in some, maybe, than others. By the way, if you don't have it, you probably have some greater problems. So don't think there's something wrong with you if you have an attraction to the opposite sex. That tells you you're normal. If you don't have an attraction to the opposite sex, regardless of what the world says, you obviously have a problem. All right? So great care has to be taken. Notice what she's saying here. Now, this is one of the, how shall I describe it? This is a very romantic passage. And you won't understand it until I explain it. sustain me with cakes of raisins, refresh me with apples, for I am lovesick. By the way, I should say one thing about the banner before we move on. A banner on a battlefield identifies your unit. And what she sees in him as they're getting to know one another is that he is beginning to unfurl his banner and say, this one belongs to me. His banner over me identifies me as his. So he's beginning to show. Young people, remember something. There's a difference between dating and courtship. And I'll explain that again. I've talked about it before. I'll get to it in a minute. But anyway, his banner over me, he's beginning to identify me as the one he wants. So she says, sustain me with cakes of raisins, refresh me with apples, for I am lovesick. And I have to tell you bluntly, that is a very sexy passage. Why? Because raisin cakes and apples were looked on as the Jews as what we call aphrodisiacs. In other words, sex potions. In other words, they excited you sexually. And what she's saying is, well, how can I put it in common terms? I want this guy. His banner over me is love. I see his attentiveness. I see that he is beginning to identify me as the one. And young people, this is why when you date, if you start dating a person consistently, number one, don't do it until you're ready to start looking seriously at a person. This idea today, well, we've dated two or three times, now she's mine and I'm hers and nobody else can date her. Forget that. That's the wrong idea. But I'll tell you how they did it in the old days. In the old days, when a guy came the third time to take a daughter out, the father met him at the door and said, what are your intentions? This is the third time you've showed up. Are you serious or not? If you're not serious, hit the road. And every daughter should have a dad that is strong enough and tough enough to whip any guy that's interested in her. I always used to say when Katie was just little, I used to say, Katie, when you grow up and you start dating, they're going to have to wrestle your two brothers and beat them before I'm going to let them show any interest in you. What? I'm going to have to get them over here. But if they're not here, I'll do. Because that young man needs to know, this is my daughter, and I consider her to be a treasure, and you don't play with my treasure. Are you serious or not? If you're not serious, you hit the road. If you are serious, then we need to sit down and set down some guidelines. And that's something that a father should do, and unfortunately we've lost that. All right? She is tempted. And then she goes on to say, may his left hand be under my head and his right hand embrace me. Now you tell me, what posture are they in? This is in her mind now. She's daydreaming. But she is thinking, essentially, I want to lay back and let him put his hand under my head and embrace me. She's becoming very, very romantic, very moved toward this guy. Again, I want to tell you something. This is the Bible. Most pastors won't teach this because they're too uptight and they couldn't teach it without blushing in the first place, and they couldn't tell it to you straight in the second place. This is normal. This is natural. She's daydreaming. She wants this guy to embrace her, but it's not yet time. And as you go through this story, you will find that sometimes she'll put on the brakes and sometimes he'll put on the brakes, but there has to be one or the other willing to put on the brakes. Temptation is normal, but you must expect it and you must prepare to get yourselves away from compromising situations. You know the best way never to fall into a temptation situation? Don't go someplace where you can. That's why in all your dating, the best thing to do in those early stages of dating is be around friends. Do it in a social gathering. Stay together. Now you can say this is old-fashioned, but I'll tell you what, it's why marriages used to last. And it's why they don't anymore. Because people date twice, hit the sack together, destroy each other's souls, end up hating each other, going their separate ways. And let me tell you something up front. There is no such thing as casual sex. No such thing. You cannot get involved sexually with a human being and not alter your soul. The Bible tells us very, very clearly, you are going to change things within your mind, within your whole psychological makeup, and it is going to affect you for the rest of your life. They used to have an old saying in the East, and they said, a young man who gives in to physical temptation before marriage will never make a real man. Now, we know that God's grace is a wonderful thing, and we know that when we fall and when we sin and fail, God forgives us and He cleanses us and He gives us strength and He restores us and He picks us up, and that's a wonderful thing. But let's don't abuse that. You know, let's don't be careless because we think, well, I can just sin and then God will pick me up. He'll pick you up, but you're going to get picked up with a lot of scars. You don't need those scars, young people. Point seven. The young man speaks up. Here she is saying, give me raisin cakes, give me apples. I'm lovesick. I want his hand under my head. I want his arm embracing me. I want this guy. What does he say? I charge you, O daughters of Jerusalem, by the gazelles or by the does of the field, do not stir up or awaken love until it pleases. Now remember, the daughters of Jerusalem are kind of in the background in this play, and they come in and they chime in and they sing their part and then they back out again. And basically what it's saying is, don't push it. Because sometimes they'll come in and they'll say, go after this guy. And then, as we saw earlier, she had to tell them, no, not until the right time. All right? So the principle is, you have to prepare for it. And if you want a real relationship, you're going to have to know how to build it. Write this principle down. True lasting love cannot be rushed. You can't rush it. You have to let it build. It takes time to build a relationship. It takes time to come to know someone. It takes time to identify that person who is compatible so that they can be what they're intended to be by God, a suitable mate, a fitted mate. They match you mentally. They match you psychologically and soulishly. They match you physically. They match you in all the areas of life. I charge you, do not stir up or awaken love. Don't rush it. Let it develop. Let it take its time. This is going to be repeated in chapter 3 and verse 5. It's going to be repeated in chapter 8 and verse 4. It's repeated for emphasis, but every time you hear this little refrain, it's like put on the brakes. You know, she's starting to think of raisin cakes and apples. And he's saying, put on the brakes. Somebody's got to put on the brakes. Write down a few things. Let me give you a couple of principles. Dating. What's the difference between dating and courtship? First of all, dating is a time to develop proper self-control. Why do you think it's hard? So that you'll learn to control yourself. Dating is a time to develop self-control and to develop proper conduct toward the opposite sex. You can't have proper conduct to someone of the opposite sex till you can first control yourself. I mean, if you every girl you see, you start drooling and slobbering at the mouth, you've got a real problem. You have to exercise self-control. You have to learn a few gentlemanly qualities, or the same for the ladies, a few ladylike qualities. You have to learn to keep yourself in control, and then you can start learning how to conduct yourself with others. Secondly, and this one's very important, I've stressed it before, in dating, there should be no strings attached. That person doesn't belong to you. You don't own them. They're not your property. You have the opportunity, and it should be understood. And by the way, young ladies, if you want to wait for the right one, you should establish in your mind this principle. You will not go out with a guy who tries to put strings on you. If he starts saying, well, we've gone out twice, here's my ring, we're going steady, you don't go with anybody else. As a matter of fact, let me just tell you, the whole idea of going steady is ridiculous. It doesn't have any place. What it is, it's like a pre-engagement engagement. Forget it. You say, well, if I don't do that for him, he'll go. Good, let him go. Better off to be rid of him, be free of him, so the right one can come along. You set it up in your mind, young ladies, and guys, you need to have this in your mind. If I ask a young lady out and she is willing to go with me, I have that date with her and that's all I'm guaranteed, and she is under no obligation to me whatsoever. You know what? They did a survey in the United States of ninth grade kids. 75% said that if you took a girl out and bought her a hamburger, she owed you sex. 75%. If you take a girl out and spend money on her, she owes you something. And even the girls thought that was the way it was supposed to be. Okay? In dating, there's no strings attached. There is no commitment beyond that date. I'll see you Friday night. You go out Friday night. If she wants to go out with someone else next Friday night, don't ever try to choke her down, because I'll tell you one thing. If she's the real one for you, she'll come back to you. And if she's not the real one for you, you're going to drive her off anyway. And you may even drive her off and she may be the right one, and you're going to end up losing her. Don't choke her. Third, there should not be any strings involved until courtship. And courtship is when the two of you sit down and you say, I believe that you are the one that I want. I believe that God has brought us together. And if you feel the same way, then from this point on, I would like to start seriously looking at preparing for marriage. Once that line's been crossed, you are no longer dating. You're in courtship, and that's where there is a sense of commitment. There is a sense of loyalty to one another, and a sense of not interested in the rest, because now you believe that you have identified this person that you want to marry. All right, verse 8 and 9. This is how she sees him. Young ladies, I hope one day you find a guy you can feel this way about. Look at this. She says she hears his voice, the voice of my beloved. Behold, he comes. This is how he shows up for a date. Leaping on the mountains, skipping on the hills, my beloved is like a gazelle or a young stag. Isn't that sexy? Behold, he stands behind our wall. He is looking through the windows. Now, he's not being a peeping Tom. He's coming around for a visit. And she sees him coming. And there he is, coming over the hill. This guy's running. And he's young, and he's strong, and he's vigorous, and he's like a stag leaping on the mountains. And that's how she feels about him. He is looking through the windows, gazing through the lattice, and then he invites her on another date. My beloved spoke and said to me, rise up, my love, my fair one, and come away. Lo, the winter is past, the rain is over and gone, the flowers appear on the earth, the time of singing has come, the voice of the turtle dove is heard in our land. You see what he's saying? What time of year is it? Springtime. Time for love. Well, there are some wonderful principles here. Genuine love produces life. Genuine love stimulates the soul. It's exciting. It builds exuberance. And folks, that's not just true when you meet. That's true as long as you have it in your relationship. As long when you and that person enter into marriage, it lasts as long as it goes if you keep it right. If you keep it right. When you and that person that you have made a commitment to, a marriage for the rest of your lives, have the compatibility of soul that you love doing what you do together. Nan and I went on a date today. Our dates have always been different. We like to do like these guys. Our dates, for the most part, were always out in the country. You don't have to blow a lot of money. Pack a picnic lunch, go find you a nice spot by a stream and have a picnic. Well, ours today, our date was a 5-hour run. That was our date. That's what we did when we were dating. And you know what? It was just as fun as it ever was then. Just as fun. And, you know, it's just so amazing when you have some. Can you imagine her saying, I don't want to go out, it's hot. I don't want to get sweaty. So there I am, going on my own. And she's at the hairdresser's or, you know. And I like to go out and I like to hike in the forest and she likes to go have her nails done. What kind of a relationship can you build? You have to be able to build a relationship because the two of you are compatible. And I see so many people, oh, we're in love. Listen, it's not going to last. If you don't have agreement about how you want to live your lives and what you want to do with your life and what the goals of your relationship are all the way down the line, it's not going to hold together. Emotional attachment is not going to hold you when there's no compatibility. You have to have that rapport in your soul, compatibility in your soul. Now, there's something else that comes out of this, and I want you to get it. Sex drive and sexual temptation, which we said is very, very normal, can be redirected into areas of interest, areas of involvement, and areas of creativity. Why do you think this guy is running up the mountains? Why do you think he is leaping from hill to hill? He's got to do something. He's got all this energy because true love creates exuberance, life, stimulation, power, and he's got to do something with it. Learn how to generate that energy into something productive and something creative. Now, I want to close with an example. I want you to listen and let me read something to you. This is from a book called Light from Many Lamps. And it has stories about a lot of people. How many of you have ever heard of Elizabeth Barrett Browning? Some of you have read things by Elizabeth Barrett Browning. Robert and Elizabeth Browning are one of the greatest love stories that you can ever run across. I want to read you a little about their love story. I want you to see what they had, because this is what I hope you find. Elizabeth Barrett Browning was very, very fragile. Her health was terrible. In the fog and the chill of London, she was an invalid and almost a recluse. Robert Browning persuaded Elizabeth Barrett to leave her invalid's couch and elope with him. She ran away and married him. And he brought her to the gentle climate for her health. They went to Italy. The climate and the love worked their magic charm. She was frail and delicate, but she was not an invalid now. She was able to move about and see the world and to be a true wife and companion to the man she admired and adored. She thought of the lines of a poem she had written, "How do I love thee? Let me count the ways. I love thee to the depth and the breadth and the height my soul can reach." A sonnet that she wrote during the time that Robert Browning was courting her at Wimpole Street in London. She was ill then, nervous and distraught, completely dominated by a tyrannical father who forbade all his children to marry. She had a very unhappy home. With unfailing devotion, Robert Browning continued to visit her, to keep her room filled with flowers, to tell her of his love, to beg her to marry him. Now remember what I said, no matter how common you may feel, here this young woman, so frail, so fragile, so sickly, and he saw in her something no other woman in the world came close to her in his eyes. So finally they eloped. During this time that they were courting, this period of emotional strain and indecision, torn between her love for Robert Browning and her fear of her father's displeasure, she began to write a sequence of love sonnets. And she wrote them in secret, and she intended to never show them to anyone. And young ladies, not until after they were married did she ever bring out the poems that she wrote for him. One sunny day in Italy, one enchanted autumn afternoon, Robert Browning read his wife's secret love sonnets for the first time, and he was profoundly moved. He recognized in them such a wonderful quality of communication and conveying love that he said, "These need to be seen by the world." And she was terrified. She said, "No, I've written these only for you. They weren't written for other people to see." And he said, "But you can't keep treasures like these from the world." And so they were finally published. You may have heard of the sonnets of the Portuguese. He used to call her his little Portuguese because she was dark and had dark hair, and so she wouldn't even put her name on them. She called them the sonnets of the Portuguese, and the world saw the poems that she wrote for him. This is one of them. Listen to what it says. The name of it is "How Do I Love Thee?" By the way, when she asked him, which one is your favorite, this was it, and this was her favorite. They both agreed, even though she had written it before they were ever married. How do I love thee? Let me count the ways. I love thee to the depth and breadth and height my soul can reach when feeling out of sight. For the ends of being and ideal grace, I love thee to the level of every day's most quiet need by sun and candlelight. I love thee freely as men strive for the right. I love thee purely as they turn from praise. I love thee with a passion put to use in my old griefs and with my childhood's faith. I love thee with a love I seem to lose with my lost saints. I love thee with a breath, smiles, tears of all my life. And if God choose, I will only love thee better after death. Isn't that beautiful? You know what? It wasn't long until Elizabeth Barrett Browning died. And I want to read you how she died. All through the long, long night, he sat by the bedside holding her hand. Sometimes she whispered his name and he bent close to listen. Always it was some word of hope or cheer or a gentle smile. And then she would doze again and he would watch and pray. By the way, both of them were Christians. My loved one, he cried, deep aching in his heart, you must get well. You cannot leave me now. Robert Browning had brought his wife to Italy, hoping a change of scene and climate would improve her health, and she had improved, so much so that they established a happy home in Florence. Here they spent their happiest years. Here they lived a life of rich contentment until now. Now he knew the ideal was over, the dream was spent, and Elizabeth was dying. Though every fiber of him cried denial, he knew the end was near, and the doctor had told him what his heart already knew. Sometime before the dawn, she moved and opened her eyes. Hold me, beloved, she whispered. He lifted her in his arms, and he sat with her near the window, holding her close in the fleecy blanket, as though by its very warmth and texture he could keep her with him. They sat for a long time in silence with her head against his shoulder. There was no need for words between them. He thought of the closing lines of one of her poems, lines he had always loved. It seemed to his anguished mind that she was speaking through her lips, that she was speaking though her lips were still. I love thee with the breath, the smiles, tears of all my life. And if God choose, I shall but love thee better after death. He bent and kissed her cheek and it felt icy to his lips. The first wan light of the new day was just beginning to come through the window when she sighed and said, it is beautiful, and she was gone. What kind of a love do you want? What kind of a relationship do you want? You want that kind? You want that kind of a love relationship, that kind of a marriage? That's the kind that God designed for you to have. That's the kind that is possible for you, it's possible for me, it's possible for all of us if we'll build it on the Bible's foundation. Now, there's no doubt in my mind that some of you are going to choose to do it your way. And I can only tell you in advance, if you choose to go your way, if you choose to follow the world's way, when you come to the end of that long, lonely road and you find your soul scarred and shattered, remember something. The grace of God is still there, and God's grace will heal you, and God's grace will lift you, but you don't have to go through those kind of things. You don't have to destroy yourself in that way. You can begin right now to say, these are the standards that I'm going to build into my life. These are the standards that I'm going to set for dating. And I want to encourage each one of you to do something in your own private time. You sit down and you take a piece of paper and you say, these are the standards that I won't violate during my dating. These are the standards that I won't violate during my courtship. This is the way my life's going to go. Because young people, if you don't plan in advance, you can't work your plan. How do you want it to go? You plan it now. And you can have this kind of a relationship. It's what God wants you to have. Let's pray. Father in heaven, we thank you for the instruction of this wonderful book, a 3,000-year-old love song and love poem that has more truth packed into it about relationships, about love, about how people can lay a foundation for a marriage that will honor Jesus Christ and fulfill and satisfy the hunger in their soul. Father, I just pray for every young person here, and I ask that by the grace of your Spirit working in their life, they would establish those standards, that they would instill those disciplines that would bring them to marriage properly prepared, the right kind of person, pure before you and before their mate, so that they can have a love relationship that will go on and on and on. We thank you, Father, for these things. In Jesus' name, amen.